podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering a master's in clinical psychology with an MFT evening format. Priority deadline to apply for September classes is July 8th. gsep.pepperdine.edu.
From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Take Two. Me, Martinez. California's fresh new budget is beefing up on its slice of Obamacare. We'll hear if Democratic presidential candidates embrace or reject the state's health coverage priorities, plus taking human bias out of criminal prosecutions.
What we're trying to do is use technology to help humans do what they do best and use computers to do what they do best.
It's all ahead on Take Two. Stay with us.
Podcasts supported by Spectrum News One. Host Alex Cohen provides a deeper look at the issues affecting Southern Californians and their communities on Inside the Issues, weeknights at 8 on Spectrum News One on Channel One, exclusively on Spectrum.
From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take Two. I'm Amy Martinez. Thanks for starting your week with us. Coming up later in today's show, we'll check in with UC Irvine, which recently declared a food insecurity emergency due to the number of students on campus who say that they cannot afford to eat. Plus, we'll go back in time at a nearby roller rink where,
after Elvis Presley, the Beatles, rock and roll came into the picture, they kind of phased out live organ music.
Except for Tuesday nights, where you can still hear organist the fabulous Dominic do his thing. But we start today with money. Now, we've probably all heard the saying, as California goes, so goes the nation. Other national heavyweights, such as Texas and New York, may disagree. But when the economy of a single state is the fifth largest in the world, anything it decides to spend a lot of money on will get a lot of attention. Now, that brings us to California's budget, which was approved last week. And one of the places the state plans to spend its money is the Affordable Care Act. California will allocate nearly $100 million on Medicare for young undocumented adults. Now, while that could be interpreted as laying the groundwork for universal health coverage, with a Democratic presidential debate set to kick off in the middle of next week, California's health care plans could help mold the political party as it tries to define itself heading into the 2020 election. Victoria Colliver wrote about this for Politico. Hello, Victoria.
Hello.
All right. Now, right off the bat, for anyone who may have missed it last week, how did California's budget double down, so to speak, on the ACA?
Well, the state doubled down in a number of directions. I think three key areas we're looking at. We're looking at the expansion for the undocumented, and that's that $98 million that you mentioned. We're talking about committing money to expand subsidies for middle-income Californians to buy health care in our exchange known as Covered California. That's been a big bugaboo in a sense that it's been, a lot of people feel it hasn't really been affordable. And then we're also going to layer on this mandate that will require folks to have coverage. And those are pretty key areas, and they're all part of the Affordable Care Act, with the exception of the undocumented coverage. But once again, California going all in and further than the Obamacare.
Now, the undocumented coverage, that is right there baked into the budget, to Gavin Newsom's first budget, right?
Yes, it is. And there was a lot of discussion, too. Do we do it just to up to age 26? And that's what they ultimately decided. Do we go to, like, older folks, the seniors 65 and older, because they're especially vulnerable, whether they're living here, you know, unauthorized or not, or the general, all of... folks here in all age groups who are undocumented. But that just seemed too big of a price tag. He bit off, like, that's the easiest group in a sense, the cheapest, the youngest folks, up to age 26. And that does align with Obamacare in the sense that young adults up to age 26 can be on their parents' coverage. And this extends it, saying on Medi-Cal, if you're income eligible, you can be on our state program. Of course, that's going to invite some controversy as well.
Yeah. Now, how are Democrats responding to California's actions on health care so far? So I know it's been just about a weekend, but what are they saying?
Yeah, Democrats on the national level or whatever. It's tough to say, but how I look at it is, you know, right now on the national level, there's been a lot of discussion about Medicare for All. And here in California, we've been talking about that for a while. We've, you know, 2 years ago in 2017, we had a single payer bill. We've had the California Nurses Association pushing it hard. It seems like in a way we've evolved a little bit, and where the national level, they're still talking straight Medicare for All. And folks in California, starting last year in earnest, started thinking, you know, this is not going to happen under the Trump administration, because because it requires federal approvals that we're just not going to get. So what can we do in the meantime to cover as many people as possible? That's what they're looking at. What are some practical steps we can take, you know, that some people think it's incremental, it's not full Medicare for all, you know, but this is something we can do.
Yeah, and Victoria, I ask that because in California, it seems like, you know, that old saying, falling along party lines, there seems to be two Democratic parties in California, the progressive wing and the more establishment wing. So I'm wondering if they both see this as possibly a model for a potential Democratic White House in 2020.
Potentially. If you talk to folks who are really true Medicare for All supporters, and that's actually really is baked into the Democratic Party. It's not that controversial to see single payers and Medicare for All as a goal. And I think they're seeing this not as an either or. They're thinking like, you know, here we are, this, as you mentioned, the state's large, the country's, the world's the fifth largest economy. Yeah. And can we as a state succeed on this level and then see what happens when we have a different administration and whether or not even we could go further. But let's look at California as an experiment on a grand scale.
Now, how much can all of this, everything we mentioned, be interpreted as the early groundwork for a single-payer system? I know Gavin Newsom wants it, but I don't know if he could do as much as he wanted maybe in year one.
Yeah. No, it's. I think the big question is because we need a lot of money to make a single-payer. It would require like all the federal Medicare dollars to come, you know, essentially be pulled into that same amount of money. And that just isn't going to happen. So this is really there's a lot of talk between single payer versus universal coverage.
Yeah.
This is like looking at, can we cover as many human beings as possible? And see how that plays out. You know, there's a lot of other questions too of whether we're going to have the capacity to cover them. That's a big question. And also, there's still some outlying questions of whether or not we might run into any sort of challenges doing this, because some of the money to expand to undocumented comes from the federal government. And the people in California seem very confident that we can use that money. It's about a quarter of what we need to expand to that population, that it's well within our realms to use that since we already get it. But who knows? I mean, a lot of these things just haven't been done before, particularly the undocumented expansion. And
California would be the first, all right? The first state to
absolutely.
To
we're the first.
Try it, yeah.
And we would have the highest subsidies, and other states have done the mandate, but, you know, they passed it. But it really hasn't gone entirely into effect in other states too, because they haven't collected that money.
Yeah.
So there's only a couple other ones. So it's new territory.
Now, Victoria, I mentioned the Democratic presidential debates are scheduled for next week. How likely mm-hmm. is it for California's moves to be brought up when the discussion eventually turns to health care?
Yeah, no, I think it would be interesting to see. We're going to all be poised to see if it is brought up, you know, obviously Kamala Harris and, you know, people who have California sensibilities, and everyone is looking toward it. It's a hard thing because it gets politically really tense between, you know, even people who support it, who talk about, I mean, and there's a little pushback from the state saying, hey, you're not going far enough on this yet. We have a huge surplus, the rainy day fund, could we go further? There's a lot of pressure within the party about this. So let's see how it plays out.
Now, this is going to be only the first debate. So I'm wondering, how wise would it be for any of the candidates to either definitively support or stiff arm California's healthcare goals? I mean, it's a coming out party for a lot of these candidates.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of support, actually. I feel like, you know, because California, you know, Governor Newsom is trying to establish himself as a healthcare governor, someone who's really pushing for it. He does have potentially, he doesn't say it, but, you know, there's a lot of people are looking at him for national aspirations as well. And if California succeeds, it's going to take a little while to see how that plays out. It, you know, this will be a feather in his cap as we move forward. So it's a bit early to say, but it's hard to ding a state that's trying to protect its people. That's from the Democrats and trying to come out and expand the ACA on this front.
That's Victoria Colliver with Politico. Victoria, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right, to another health matter now. Nearly half of all college students in this country fear they will not be able to afford food. That's according to the Hope Center for College, Community, and Justice, a nonprofit research organization focused on higher education and social policies. Now, UC Irvine student government has declared food insecurity a campus emergency and is allocating $400,000 to something called the Fresh Basic Needs Hub. That's an on-campus resource center and food pantry. For more on how the University of California system as a whole is responding to students' food insecurity, we have Andrea Gutierrez. She's a director of the Fresh Basic Needs Hub at UC Irvine. Andrea, welcome to Take Two.
Hello, how's it going?
Good, good. Now tell us a bit more about the Fresh Basic Needs Hub at UC Irvine. Why was it founded and what does it do for students?
Of course. So about 4 years ago, we started an effort on campus to address food insecurity for our students. At that point, we were collaborating with the student government to really understand what our students were going through when they were telling us that they were skipping meals. At the same time, the University of California, Office of the President, had committed some seed funding for us to start food pantries all over the system. And so after 2 years of running a small pantry program, we knew that it was time to expand and really offer more holistic resources for our students who were literally just having trouble affording the entirety of their experience at UCI. And so the Fresh Basic Needs Hub was born as a center that will be dedicated to serve our students' basic needs. Of course, our pantry has continued to be our most visible and most used program, but we have been able to add a number of programs, right, such as collaborating with our local county to enroll students into our CalFresh program, right, which is the California's version of SNAP. And we have also devised a new program to offer meals to students that may not qualify for CalFresh but still need support. We also have a grant, an emergency grant, to support students with their housing, food needs, and even medical bills. And at the same time, we offer a variety of life skills programming to support them with their skills into adulthood.
So it sounds like a one-stop food shop in a way.
Exactly. We definitely wanted a space, right, where students could stop and receive all the different support systems without having to go to different offices in the campus.
All right, so this center is already helping students who are food insecure. What's the emergency that led to this $400,000 cash infusion, and how will that money be spent?
Of course. So our center was actually not involved with declaring an emergency on campus. We have been doing this work for the past 4 years, but my sense is that our student government really wanted to make a statement of how much they care about the student body and their wellness, right? And they wanted to make sure that there was a sense of urgency to be able to do more for this work, right? Because although we are serving the need, we know that there are many students that may not know about us yet. And so the funds are going to be allocated in four different ways. One of the biggest pieces is going to go towards directly just procuring more food to be able to extend the hours of operation of our pantry and to have it fully stocked pretty much throughout the whole day.
Yeah.
The second part of the allocation is to hire a full-time clinical caseworker to be present at our center, to be able to meet with students that perhaps are facing a multitude of challenges, right? And to be able to provide that one-on-one support to them at the center without having to wait a couple days for an appointment. And thirdly, we are going to fund our emergency meal swipe program. So we're going to buy about 10,000 meals from our UCI dining partners to be able to distribute those to students who have shown high need. And lastly, we'll be able to hire a couple student interns to help with the additional work that this is going to create.
Is there a basic needs program on every UC campus?
Definitely. So the UCs have been very coordinated since the beginning, since really 4 years ago. So every campus at this point has a space where students can show up to access emergency food and help with CalFresh. It does look a little bit different on each campus. Not everyone has a one-stop center. At this point, Irvine, Berkeley, Davis, and San Diego do have them, but there is a similar program and full-time staff person at every UC.
We're talking to Andrea Gutierrez, director of the Fresh Basic Needs Hub at UC Irvine, an on-campus resource center and food pantry. Andrea, how are the UCs coordinating around this issue of student food insecurity?
Of course. So for the past 4 years, we've had a basic needs system-wide committee that is comprised of different members of each UC. So each UC has two co-chairs and a working group dedicated to basic needs. And then we all get together at least 2 to 3 times a year in person, and we have monthly conference calls to be able to share best practices. At the same time this year, our Board of Regents has created a basic needs committee, which is going to serve as the leading committee for the coordination of all 10 campuses.
You know, I was wondering if, you know, some people might not know what food insecurity is. It goes a little bit beyond just being hungry, right?
Of course. So food insecurity really is both about quality of food and quantity of food, right? So if a student is not eating enough meals, they are facing food insecurity, right? But if a student is also eating three meals a day, but not the right types of food, right? Perhaps buying the cheapest food that they can find because that's all they can afford, that is also someone facing food insecurity because they are not receiving the types of food that they need to be nourished.
Generally, Andrea, what are the underlying causes of food insecurity?
So there's a few factors, right? I think one is the fact that living costs are at an all-time high, right? I think in higher ed, we focus only on tuition and fees, and oftentimes don't really pay attention to what's called the non-educational costs, but in reality, they are educational costs, right? Such as food and housing, yeah. Transportation, clothing for your interviews and your internships, right? At the same time, we do have a college demographic that is continuously changing. At UCI specifically, right, we have 50% of our student body being first-gen students, meaning the first ones in their families to go to college. At the same time, we have large number of students who come from low-income families, right? We have a lot more non-traditional students returning to college later in life with children sometimes, right? And with families that they have to support on a student budget. Beyond that, I think it's also the fact that there has been a continuous disinvestment in higher ed, both from our federal and state governments, right? So our government's spending less per student, you know, now than it did 20 years ago. So it's really a combination of all these factors that are making the college affordability question so difficult for our students, especially when they come from less privileged backgrounds.
You know, we've spoken to students in the past who know that with their budget, they have to spend money on tuition because that's how they're going to stay students, enroll in the school. But then they make choices on rent or eating. I mean, that's as basic as it gets for some students. And Andrea, this is a short-term solution. So what happens when the money runs out? What can be done in the long term?
Yeah, so there's definitely, you know, this trend that we have been going through and just operating on one-year funds. We do have a budget going forward beyond this $400K allocation, right, because we have been a functioning center. However, right, we are looking at longer-term strategies and solutions, right, that will need policy changes, right? We need to be able to look at how financial aid is working in California and beyond and try to see if there's any possibilities for financial aid reform and adjusting the numbers, right, that our students are receiving, especially adjusting for inflation, right, and cost of living. At the same time, I know that there's been conversations about expanding, for example, our K-12 free and reduced lunch program into higher ed to be able to better support our low-income students. I think here on the ground, we are really invested in increasing the expansion or the awareness of our CalFresh program, because we do know that this is a federally funded program, right, that contributes to the economy. And we have thousands of students who qualified, but we still have to push through some of the awareness raising challenges. And yeah. So we know we are actively working with our counties. And lastly, we actually have Governor Newsom committing potentially some funding towards basic needs for the UCs and the other two segments. So we're waiting for July to happen.
Andrea Gutierrez, director of the Fresh Basic Needs Hub at UC Irvine, an on-campus resource center and food pantry. Andrea, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.
All right. Lately, we've been hearing about how atmospheric rivers have been dousing the LA area with more rain than we may be ready to handle. The flooding we've seen from time to time is an example of what they can do. Coming up, California has had enough of being at the whim of atmospheric rivers. So in the future, we might be able to harness when the water hits the drought. That's coming up when Take Two continues. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm A. Martinez. The California Senate and Assembly approved a $215 billion budget on Friday. Now, within that is an unprecedented amount of funding for early childhood programs, everything from preschool to pay for educators to paternal leave. Add it all up, and it's nearly $2 billion. KPCC's early childhood reporter Priska Neely is here to talk with us about the funding and what state leaders are hoping to accomplish for young children and their families. Hello, Priska.
Hey.
All right, seems like there's a lot to pay attention to in this budget.
Yes, and you know, in previous years, when you go on the website and look at the budget, you'll see a tab for public safety, transportation, K-12, and there was never one section for early childhood, but that's there now. So in this budget, there's funding for facilities updates and for a data system and for home visiting programs. And you know, just as a reminder, Governor Gavin Newsom really sees investing in early childhood as a really important part of of the puzzle when it comes to reducing childhood poverty, closing the school readiness gap, you know, reducing crime and lots of other things. And as I say frequently, you know, children turn into adults.
Eventually.
So what happens to them in the first years of life, you know, really matters.
Yeah. Now, okay, first thing, let's dig into preschool. Governor Newsom has said that a long-term goal would be establishing universal preschool where all children, regardless of income, would have access, just like with public school.
Yeah, so that, you know, we're still a long way off from that universal preschool idea, but this budget takes a step towards getting there. So it would make it so that all four-year-olds in neighborhoods where 80% of the kids attending a school are low income, so all of the four-year-olds would be eligible for preschool, for state-subsidized preschool slots in those areas, not just the low-income families. So those families would still have priority, but this would expand access so that middle-income families who may be right on the cusp of eligibility for those state subsidized programs, they would also be, you know, have a chance to get into those programs. So it's a step towards universal preschool.
Now, another big item that lots of people will want to pay attention to is parental leave. Now, I remember back in January seeing a lot of headlines that Gavin Newsom wanted to extend the state policy from 6 weeks to 6 months. Is that happening?
That is not happening at this time. And, you know, when that proposal was unveiled, it would, you know, it would be the largest in the whole in the country. And a lot of people were asking, how is that going to work? What we're seeing in this budget is an extension from 6 weeks to 8 weeks. And so that would be for each parent or caregiver. And then another issue that you hear a lot around parental leave is that low-income jobs and low-income workers won't really take advantage of it because they would only get 70% of wages during that time. But this deal, lawmakers are raising that wage replacement to 90% for low-income workers.
All right. Have there been maybe other changes for early childhood programs from when this was first proposed back in January?
You know, most of the things that the governor laid out in that initial January proposal are still in there. And this cycle is really different from what we saw with Governor Brown. But in these past few months, there's really been a lot of fine tuning. So the final budget has more funding for data collection around early childhood. So $20 million is going through different data systems statewide that could track children and track child care providers, because it's kind of the Wild West out of there. And there's so many funding streams, it's very overwhelming. There are also big changes to proposals around full day kindergarten. Right now, some districts only offer it for a few hours a day. And back in January, Newsom proposed $750 million so that districts could update their classrooms and expand their programs. But advocates were saying that that didn't really make sense. And analysis from UC Berkeley showed that many districts in low-income areas already had full-day kindergarten. So the money would actually just be going to wealthier districts who could spruce up their classrooms, and it may only deepen disparities. So now that funding has been combed down to just $300 million. So there were a lot of examples of areas where it seemed like the advocates and researchers were being heard.
And it sounds like this was really a different process, and advocates are happy overall, but were there any areas that experts feel were maybe missed out on?
Yeah, so one area that I know about is that some people were hoping to see more of a change in the system that could actually help to raise wages for early educators. Child care providers and other early educators are some of the lowest paid of any profession. And there are a lot of gaps when you look at the difference between preschool teachers and elementary school teachers. But I talked to Nina Boothy, who's the executive director of Every Child California, and that's an association that represents people who run preschool and child care programs. And she was a member of the state assembly's Blue Ribbon Commission on Early Childhood Education, and they came out with all of these recommendations earlier this year. And one of them was to change the reimbursement system for child care providers. So without getting too into the weeds, you know, state subsidized problems, they get a certain amount of money back for every child every day. And most of that goes to the wages. So if those reimbursement rates were higher, programs could pay the educators more. And right now there's a really complicated system, and advocates were hoping to streamline that process and change the way that rates are established so that they could be more reflective of, you know, cost of living and other factors. But that change didn't happen. Here's Nina Boothy.
By having those reimbursement rates artificially low, we're not doing a lot to help increase wages, you know, for those individuals who work in the early care and education field.
So that concern wasn't addressed this time around. So it's something we'll be watching for the future.
All right. Before we let you go, I wanted to ask you about a report out today looking at child well-being. This is the Kids Count data book released annually. What's the picture for California this year?
The short answer is California is not doing well. Yikes. And it's behind a lot of states when it comes to education, health, and well-being for kids. The state ranked 35th nationally overall. It was at 46th when it was at economic well-being, you know, as we just talked about, cost of living. A lot of burdens for families came in at 36th for education. So fourth grade reading levels are really behind, and half of the state's 3- and 4-year-olds are not in school.
All right. Prisca Neely, KPCC's early childhood reporter. Prisca, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Staying with the state budget, California has allocated just over $9 million of its $214.8 billion budget for the study of atmospheric rivers. Last winter, these sorts of storms caused mudslides here in the Southland and generated rain totals well above normal. For more on atmospheric rivers and why it's necessary to study them, we have Daniel Swain. He's a climate scientist at UCLA's Institute of the Environment and Sustainability. Welcome back to Take Two.
Thanks for having me.
Right. Now, atmospheric rivers are something we've only just started hearing a lot about. For listeners who maybe aren't familiar with the term, briefly explain what an atmospheric river is.
Atmospheric rivers are plumes of really concentrated water vapor in the atmosphere, and they occur almost continuously somewhere on Earth. At any given moment, there's usually about 4 of them somewhere in the world. But when they affect California, typically during the rainy season, so during the winter months, they actually bring a large fraction of California's water supply, but they also are responsible for, as you mentioned, a large majority of California's major flood events.
Okay, now a lot of research and prevention is going toward drought and wildfires. Why aren't atmospheric rivers getting as much attention, you think?
Well, I think in recent years in California, we've experienced a lot of drought and, unfortunately, a lot of really devastating and increasingly large wildfires. And so that has rightfully captured a lot of public and public policy attention. But California is also a region that is intrinsically vulnerable to really big flood events. They just don't happen as often as the wildfires do. And so I think we tend to have a short memory when it comes to the flood risk in California. And it's also the case that the risk of flood is changing in a warming world.
So why do you think now, Daniel, is the time to really research atmospheric rivers?
Well, partly it's because I think there's been a sort of a revolution in understanding about how to think about natural disasters and how they interact with highly populated places. California sort of has a unique confluence of big cities that are at risk of big disasters, whether it's earthquakes or wildfires or big floods. And I think the second reality is that our climate is changing and warming at the same time that the population of the state is increasing. So there's both more people in harm's way from a lot of these sorts of events, but the events themselves are also changing. And there's a lot of recent research suggesting that not only are atmospheric rivers becoming themselves warmer and producing warmer rains at higher elevation and less snow and more liquid water in the mountains, which has implications for water supply and flood risk, but that in the future, atmospheric rivers are likely to become considerably more intense. So even if California's climate doesn't necessarily become wetter on average, our rain is expected to come in increasingly short but very sharp bursts. So the risk of floods associated with atmospheric rivers is likely to increase quite a bit moving forward.
So then climate change is affecting the atmospheric rivers because it definitely has affected drought and fire. And so the natural extension would go toward atmospheric rivers and their intensity in the future?
That's right. One of the clearest implications of global warming, aside from increasing temperatures, is the fact that the amount of water vapor in the atmosphere increases actually very quickly. So even with relatively small increases in temperature, the amount of moisture and potential rainfall actually increases exponentially. So even though we are seeing an increase in the risk of wildfire and droughts in places like California, we're simultaneously seeing an increase in the risk of these really extreme precipitation events. And so we sort of need to be thinking about all of these things at once.
And Daniel, I'm going to guess then that that's one of the biggest reasons why atmospheric river research should get state-level funding, in your opinion, probably.
Yeah, I think California is a bit of a special case in the sense that we are uniquely dependent on atmospheric rivers for much of our water supply, but also uniquely vulnerable to them on the flood risk side of things. And as both the risk of water scarcity and of flood is expected to increase with climate change, this is an important region to be understanding how these changes are actually going to evolve over time. And this is particularly true because I think at the state level right now, there are conversations about how we can essentially harness some of these big pulses of water during the extreme rainfall events and use them in beneficial ways during other periods when we have water scarcity. So whether that's managing our groundwater aquifers more effectively, in some cases we may even be able to redirect floodwaters into regions where they can recharge these groundwater aquifers and provide us with greater resilience to drought in the dry years. So there are interesting sorts of research questions that relate to both drought and flood at once, and how we can reduce the risks of flood and potentially reduce the risks of drought at the same time.
Daniel Swain is a climate scientist at UCLA's Institute of the Environment and Sustainability. Daniel, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right, I'm going to reveal a bias that I have had since I was a little kid. You got to remember, I grew up in the 80s. Anytime at all that I see someone walking around LA with a Boston Celtics jersey, flaunting it in the middle of purple and gold Lakerland, I get a preconceived feeling that that person is just looking for an argument. Now, generally, that one is a harmless bias, but as human beings, we all have them in some way or another. Thing is, though, in some cases, as in the legal system, it can have much more serious consequences. Coming up, how technology could remove bias in criminal prosecutions. That's ahead when Take Two continues.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering a doctorate of education in organizational leadership, developing graduates with the knowledge and ability to transform organizations for optimal success and growth. An online hybrid tailored for working professionals with attendance only twice per term in West LA. Attend an information session to learn more. Classes start September. Apply by July 8th for a $1,000 scholarship at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
Podcasts supported by Spectrum News One, where talk meets action, where politicians meet constituents, where issues meet understanding. Join host Alex Cohen for Inside the Issues on Spectrum News One, a nightly political show that takes you inside the issues affecting you, your family, and your community. Inside the Issues, weeknights at 8 on Spectrum News One on Channel One, exclusively on Spectrum.
Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. The San Francisco District Attorney is launching a new computer program aimed at reducing implicit bias in criminal prosecutions. Now, it works by removing certain pieces of information from police reports, such as the race of the suspect, before attorneys review them to make decisions about that case. The program was designed by Sherrod Goyle. He's a professor at Stanford University who studies the intersection of computers and social science. And he's on the line to explain how technology could help us understand human bias and actually maybe get rid of it. Welcome to Take Two.
Hi, thanks for having me.
All right, so tell us about this program you created for the San Francisco DA and how you came up with it.
Yeah, so it's a pretty simple idea, and the idea came from the DA himself. When officers submit report, they often write details that would reveal the race of the individual who was arrested. Now, attorneys in the DA's office, when they see these things, we worry that maybe they're going to be prejudiced by the race of the suspect. And so we built a program that tries to mask all those features. And so we're taking out words like Black or Hispanic, or even things like location, which someone might infer to determine what the individual's race is.
But isn't it helpful, though, to have certain things to help make a picture clearer about a victim or a suspect?
I think it goes both ways. I mean, on the one hand, you want all the information possible to make the best possible decision. And on the other hand, we don't want extraneous information like race to come in and sort of skew our opinions. And so the way we built the system is two phases. In the first phase, we strip away all of that information that we don't think is going to really help make that decision the first time, like race, like location. And then when the attorneys have made their initial decision, we show them all of the information, the original unredacted report. And they have the option to go back and change their decision if they think it makes sense. But the catch here is that they have to explain why they're doing that. And so we're trying to build a system that lets people have the best of both worlds.
Wondering, what would it take for other cities to use this, maybe here in Los Angeles? How much interest have you gotten on this?
So we would love to partner with jurisdictions across the country to make this available. We're releasing everything as open source software. And so free of charge, jurisdictions can just reach out and play with the software themselves or call us up, and we'd be happy to help them implement this thing.
Now, you study computers and social science. Generally speaking, how can computers be used to understand bias and then maybe eliminate it?
What we found is that using lots of data can often help detect bias that is just hard to do with anecdotes. So for one example, over the last 5 years, we've been collecting hundreds of millions of traffic stop records from across the United States. Now, if you look at any one of these incidents in and of themselves, you don't really know what drove an officer's decision to carry out a search. But in aggregate, when you look at everything together, when you look at all these hundreds of millions of interactions, then a pretty clear pattern emerges that, in fact, we are finding evidence of racial bias in certain police actions.
Talking to Shared Goyal. He's a professor at Stanford University who studies the intersection of computers and social science. Now, I can already hear people say, okay, what about human perspective? It can be more nuanced maybe than a computer program's, and that humans might actually be helpful in certain situations. Why are you trying to eliminate human perspective?
So we're definitely not trying to eliminate a human perspective. What we're trying to do is use technology to help humans do what they do best and use computers to do what they do best. And so in this particular example, working with the DA's office in San Francisco, we're using computers to strip out all of these characteristics and narrative that humans might not even know that they're relying on when it comes to decisions, and allowing humans to focus on the things that we think are most important.
Now, I remember a couple of years ago, ProPublica looked at a program used to determine risk when giving people bail, and it found that it labeled people of color as riskier. So wondering, to what extent is bias still a problem even when we use technology, because technology is made by humans?
So definitely one has to worry about baking in bias. I mean, we're using historical data to build these types of applications. And wherever you do that, you're worried that you might just entrench decades or even centuries of discrimination into these tools. So one way that we've tried to get around this problem is to make everything very simple. And so think of this system that we're building as just a fancy search and replace. And so we look for words, we look for phrases that might, again, be indicative of someone's race or ethnicity, and we strip those out. And by doing this in a relatively transparent way, we're hoping that we're not introducing new biases while we're doing this. But again, like you point out, this is a very real concern. And so we're going to kind of continually audit the system to make sure that we're not inadvertently baking in these types of biases.
The program in San Francisco, how long would it take for you to determine whether it is a success in the way you maybe imagine a success to be for this?
So we're hoping within the next few months we'll have some evidence to figure out if this is actually working, if charging decisions are changing, and if we find some evidence that decisions are in fact more equitable across race groups in San Francisco.
All right, we'll check back. Shared Goyal is a professor at Stanford University who studies the intersection of computers and social science. We've been talking with him about how technology might be able to help reduce implicit bias. Shared, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
All right, now to a business story. Immigrants take big risks coming to California, and once here, many take another risk, starting a business. California immigrants are actually more likely to become entrepreneurs than people born here. As part of our California Dream collaboration, KPCC's David Wagner went to the heart of LA's Thai community to see how immigrant entrepreneurs shape our economy.
Ira Rin Srivada sets up her booth at the East Hollywood Farmers Market. She tapes up a sign with the name she chose to describe her food, SoZap.
It's like a zap. It's, I mean, delicious, so delicious.
Her dad helps out. He grinds fresh ingredients for a spicy and sweet papaya salad. She makes Thai food the way she learned from her mom and dad, growing up in northeastern Thailand. LA has the largest Thai population outside of Thailand, so she's betting a lot of people here crave the real thing. And she has big plans for SoZap. She's going to move into a food hall opening up soon called the Thai Town Marketplace. She's happier working for herself. Since coming to LA, she's had a lot of different jobs. She's been an Uber driver, she's been a server in a restaurant. She says that wasn't what she wanted to do, but it's where she discovered a valuable skill. The restaurant didn't have desserts, so she started making mango sticky rice. It was a hit. She branched out and sold her food at a local Thai temple. SoZap is her first attempt at starting her own business. It's hard, tiring work, but she loves it and hopes the risk pays off. Back in Thailand, Srirada had a successful career in the makeup industry. Her plan was to be a makeup artist for film and TV, but she couldn't get her foot in the door. Harvard Business School professor Bill Kerr says that's a pretty common story for immigrants who become their own boss. He says a lack of good job opportunities can push immigrants into entrepreneurship.
And so in those settings, they may find starting their own company to be the most attractive option.
But it's not a fallback for everyone. Many come to California with a specific business plan in mind.
Especially if you are launching a scalable national and internationally focused business.
About half of California's Fortune 500 companies were started by immigrants or the children of immigrants.
They are really the engines for our local economy.
Linda Lopez heads the LA Mayor's Office of Immigrant Affairs. She says it's not just big companies. Immigrants also own many of LA's small businesses.
Their businesses generate about 3.5 billion or 45.6% of all the self-employed income in the city.
Immigrant entrepreneurs are creating jobs and paying taxes across California. Immigrants create about 40% of all new businesses in California, making it one of the top states for immigrant entrepreneurship.
Wanna help me open that?
Chancey Martorell with the Thai Community Development Center doesn't want those opportunities to disappear. That's why she's so excited to see the Thai Town Marketplace Food Hall finally under construction.
So SoZap will have that stall. She has an ideal stall because it's going to be fronting the sidewalk.
The Thai Town Marketplace has been Martorell's passion project for years. Rents for commercial space have gone up. She sees low-income entrepreneurs struggling to get bank loans. She wants this food hall to give today's immigrants their shot at opening a small business.
Otherwise, you end up just seeing a community of chain stores that have no history in the community. And so that's what we're trying to prevent.
Back at the East Hollywood Farmers Market, Ira Rin Srirada sees a big future for SoZap. She says if she can save enough, she wants to open up more than one SoZap.
Thank you.
In Los Angeles, I'm David Wagner.
All right, generally if you show up to a roller skating rink, you're going to be grooving to some kind of top 40 song. Now that's the standard roller rink MO, except if you're in Glendale, where you'll hear the pleasing pipes of maybe the last roller rink organist in California. Coming up, get to know the fabulous Dominic. He's next when Take Two continues in 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm A. Martinez. All right, let's go back in time a bit to a place that's brought people together for decades and survived really all kinds of fads. It's the Moonlight Rollerway, which sits along an industrial stretch of San Fernando Road in Glendale. If you want to skate to your heart's content, rolling to tunes new and old, that is the place. But on Tuesday nights, the soundtrack is special. A Hammond organ filters throughout the rink and into the parking lot. It's courtesy of a guy who calls himself the Fabulous Dominic. He's 85 years old and is recognized as the last roller skate rink organist in California. Now, he also happens to own the place. Peter Gilstrap brings us this story, which first appeared on KQED's The California Report.
This is roller skating, America's favorite fun sport, a wholesome year-round recreation. one of our truly great all-American participant sports.
That's the way it was in the early 1950s when the Roller Skating Foundation of America made this promo film right around the time the Moonlight Rollerway opened its doors. And that's also when Dominic Cangelosi first took command of a skating rink organ at the original Moonlight location in nearby Pasadena.
And at that time, in the 50s, there was nothing but live organ music in most roller skating rinks around the country.
Business was so good that the Moonlight expanded, buying this rink in Glendale in 1963. Cangelosi worked both places, but as the years went by, the glory days of skating to an organ began to disappear.
Back in the 70s and 80s, I was still working as the staff organist, only part-time, because after Elvis Presley, the Beatles, rock and roll came into the picture, they kind of phased out live organ music in the skating rinks.
But that did not stop Cangelosi. He was determined to keep the sound alive for diehard rollers who craved the human touch. In 1985, he dropped $96,000 and bought the rink.
Since I was the organist here for so many years and I took over the business, I kept the live organ music going at least one night a week.
That night is Tuesday, and Tuesday is tonight. It's almost 8 p.m., almost time for Cangelosi to fire up the mighty Hammond B3 organ. He sits and opens a spiral notebook filled with aging sheet music. But before he starts, he's on the mic offering a bit of simple Zen guidance that applies as much to a roller rink as it does to human existence.
Do not stop along the rails. You can fall down and get up as quickly as you can.
And then it begins. As they have for decades, people start to skate clockwise under the giant mirrored ball. They're gliding slowly, arms out to the sides. Some are awkward, some are graceful, but almost everyone is smiling.
Dominic is special. He puts emotion into his music.
That's Michael Mannix. He's been here nearly every Tuesday for the last quarter century.
His music makes me skate. I just follow the music and I feel so happy.
The music is a nice, relaxing time.
Queenie Black is back at the rink for the first time in 3 years. Before that, she was a longtime regular and a big Dominic fan.
And it's funny, too, sometimes he will play modern songs, but he'll have the organ playing like he's like, da, 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 you know.
Dominic adapts new songs as well as old songs, Broadway musical songs, everything to his organ, and he plays all tempos. And people come all from all over just to listen to his music.
Betty Palubeski is the rink manager. She also works the register and the skate counter and pretty much anything else that needs doing in the place. She's been on the job for 26 years.
Tuesday night, it kind of takes you back in time and makes you feel, it doesn't matter how old you are, it makes you feel young.
We do have a following. They're old-timers, and we're getting new people all the time. And a lot of young people that find it very interesting to skate to live organ music because it's not heard anywhere else but in a roller rink.
One of those young people is about to step into the rink. He has spiky hair dyed white, a ring in his nose, and in large Gothic letters across the front of his throat, there's a tattoo that says, "Leave me alone."
I'm Cody Littlefield. What else did you need? Sorry.
Oh, and this is your first time?
Yeah, it's my first time here. Never been here before.
What do you think?
I love it. The music is sweet, and it makes me want to skate.
And then he leaves the walking world and joins the hypnotic circular parade of skaters. Dominic's organ guides them all into the only time machine with a mirror ball and a snack bar.
What is the future for a roller rink with a live organist?
I don't know. It's just not going to be any after I'm gone. I don't have anybody looking to be a skating rink organist anymore.
So the position could be open?
Yes, it could be. If somebody wanted to step up, I'd be glad to train them.
Cangelosi's shoes are big and fabulous. Filling them will be no easy task. But for now, the organ is alive and well, and the Tuesday nights roll on and on. For the California Report, I'm Peter Gilstrap in Glendale.
All right, if you missed any part of the show today, we got you. Don't worry. Just go to the Take Two podcast wherever you get your podcasts. You can also interact with us. If something motivated you enough to write something down, you can do it in a tweet. We're at Take Two, at Take Two. You can find me there as well, at A Martinez LA. That's at A Martinez LA. That's good for Twitter and Instagram for your social media convenience. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take Two. We'll be back tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then.